Talk given Sunday, 27th April, 1980. Life, in the total meaning of the word life, and not exclusively in its biological sense, brings each member of any species to birth, and it is life which manifests the ending of that particular member by means of the phenomenon we call death. With respect to us human beings, a living structure grows from the moment of conception within the maternal womb, leaves the womb at parturition, enters a new environment, and is born as a particular, unique being into our everyday world. The mechanism which has made evolution possible is the sexual process. Each parent produces a generative cell, a gamete as it is called, and the union of the male and female gametes produce a zygote which can develop into a new individual. The development of the gamete, male and female, is a process which differs from that which occurs in the production of non-reproductive cells, for it involves the rearrangement. This is the important point to bear in mind. It involves the rearrangement of the genetic material inherited by the mother and the father from their respective parents. The union of the male and the female gamete produces a new individual, different from the parents, and also from every other individual that ever was and ever will be. For such is the complexity and variability of living matter. Every new life is a new creation with something new to contribute to the future of humanity, and new in possibilities of mental and spiritual development. This latter development, the mental and the spiritual, is dependent on the physical development of the body plus the influence of the environment. This is not a transference from a pre-existent person, and so is incompatible with any theory of the reincarnation of a permanent identifiable entity from a past existence. Our psychical activity of thought and feeling is dependent upon the interaction of parts of the highly complex central nervous system. When the brain is damaged, thought and feeling are extinguished or changed. When we die, the central nervous system, and with it the record of thought and feeling in each lifetime, in each living person who dies, disintegrate completely. That is, the psychophysical organism dies completely. The psychophysical organism is the existential being, the existent who is here and now, and only in the here and the now as such. You see, he is the existent. So the psychophysical being dies completely, and with his death, the misconception, I am I, as a permanent, unchanging, identifiable entity, separate forever from all else, disappears absolutely. That I am I consciousness comes into being after the birth of a human being. And it, with the death of that being, the I am I consciousness completely disappears, because there is no such thing, no such entity, which is a permanent, unchanging entity. Now this, as you know, is in line with the Buddhist analysis of the existential being. Do bear in mind the existential being, the temporal, the temporary existent in this world. And in this connection, I think it would be interesting to read something which the Buddha said when he gave that wonderful discourse entitled the Brahmajala Sutta. The Brahmajala means the perfect net. Jala is net. And Brahma means literally, of course, divine, the divine net. And it was called the divine net by the Buddha when his disciple Ananda asked him, what shall we call this discourse? How shall we name it? And he gave the name himself. In this discourse, he expounded the 62 prevalent systems of philosophy, and pointed out their defects, and showed how they arise in the minds of the people who propounded them, and where their shortcomings lie. But if anyone has really come to the full fruition of his human possibilities, and is capable of being constantly awake in the supreme meditative state, then he would know that which is transcendentally true, which is the one and only truth, and is not a particular conception or a set of conceptions, which are all no conceptions in relation to the truth of things. Towards the end of this discourse, he says, the outward form, O monks, of him who has won the truth, the Tathagata, he who has gone thus, stands before you, but that which binds it to rebirth is cut in twain. Now it is translated as rebirth here, but jati is a word which means the conditioned state. Birth is a conditioned state, and death is also a conditioned state. We'll perhaps touch upon that a little later. Is cut in twain. So long as his body shall last, so long do gods and men behold him. Note carefully, he uses the word body. So long as the body lasts, gods and men behold him. On the dissolution of the body, beyond the end of his life, neither gods nor men shall see him. And we must bear in mind also the analytical presentation of the existential being. There is the shape or form, there is sensation, feeling, there are thoughts, There are thought patterns, confections really is the best word, and and there is discriminative consciousness. All of them are continuously changing, and there is nothing whatsoever in any of them which is a permanent, changeless, identifiable entity. Nothing whatsoever. So that the existential being who comes into this world because he is expressed, pressed out of the total, the infinite, the one reality, the eternal and the immortal, he is pressed out of it, and therefore he manifests in terms of finitude, temporality and mortality that which is infinite, eternal and immortal. It's not easy to grasp these things because we are so conditioned by all our upbringing education, our socio-cultural heritage, and by our own natural failings and incapacities to see sufficiently deeply into reality. Therefore, we cling to this idea of there is something which is permanent. That is something which can be identified. But if you want that which is permanent, well, then it is the one total reality itself. And the manifestation of that one total reality consists of altogether impermanent, mortal, temporal manifestations, and that's all there is to it. So, personality as such disappears altogether, but there is no such thing as utter annihilation. The ultimate reality remains the ultimate reality. It was that before you or I was expressed, before you or I are expressed, and then at death, that which is expressed is completely dead, but it has been taken up into non-being. Non-being is not the absolute opposite of being. Non-being is a reality. Non-being is a term which one can apply to the total, to the one total reality as such. This is why Sri Krishna in the Gita says to Arjuna, when he reveals what he himself is, being and non-being am I, O Arjuna. Death and the origin of all things to come am I, O Arjuna. And if one successfully meditates into the deep meaning of that, one will see that oneself, the being, through the instrumentality of death, is completely changed into non-being. You don't exist as a particular entity inside non-being. Non-being can only be the one only, the absolute alone. That absolute aloneness is something which is realized consciously in the supreme meditative state. That supreme meditative state, which has been called by so many different names, Samadhi, or the Unio Mystica, and so on. You see, the God become, as it is put in the Upanishads, the Brahman become, he who has realized the Atma, and so forth. Now, when such things do take place, whilst the body is alive, you, the particular person here, the identifiable entity, have completely transcended all the limitations of identifiable entity, and the realization of the transcendent fact, the ultimate transcendent reality, has become manifest through you, in you, yourself. any other person, living person, who has the same ability, who has reached that stage, he would know that you had reached that stage simply by being in your presence. Just as without talking or without doing anything, we hear in each other's presence, see each other, and we know there's another human being. In the same way, the perfected Holy One knows another perfected Holy One without utilizing any of our means of expression or knowledge or observation. There is this transcendental consciousness at work. So, this statement of the Buddha can also be understood as signifying that when the body dies, as such, the existential being is completely wiped out. There is no survival of personality whatsoever, nor, on the other hand, is there anything like utter annihilation. This is the marvel of the whole situation. The word used, this is the Pali text as such, the word used, of course, for the body is kaya, which does mean the body, the physical body, the existent being. And it is not to be restricted just to the physical body as we understand it when we use the English language and say physical body. It is the whole existential person. The body, as we know it, the feelings, thoughts, ideas, discriminative consciousness, it includes all that, you see. So, we can see how the finite being interplays with the one infinite non-being. Death is the doorway which enables life as limitedly manifested in oneself to enter or to go back, life, the impersonal life itself, to go back to the infinite, eternal and immortal life, the non-being state. They interplay with each other. The non-being state expresses multitudinous beings. Every single being at death, you see, this is the difficulty of language. If I say re-enters, it means, it gives the impression re-enters as a particular entity. But it is not as a particular entity. Particularity absolutely vanishes in the infinite. Otherwise it is not infinite. There is an infinite plus a particular entity. And that cannot be the case. So we may ask the question, how then does the misconception of separate entity, I am I, arise? And what is its significance and use in the life of mankind? The misconception arises through the imperfections and limitations of sense perception and experience. The bulk of us human beings, unless we are unfortunately afflicted by the absence of any one sense functioning properly, such as sight or hearing or touch or taste or whatever it is, you see, we imagine that we human beings function fully in the as far as sense impressions are concerned. We don't. And in this connection, there is a very delightful account in that story of the blind man and the elephant. I think some of you, or all of you perhaps, know it. It comes in the treatise known as the Verses of Uplift, chapter 6, section 4. The disciples of the Buddha come to him and say that there are so many wanderers in the forest who belong to different sects and have different ideas and different beliefs and practices and so forth. And the Buddha says to them that these wanderers do not know what true religion is, the Dhamma, nor do they know and understand what is not Dhamma. I use the word Dhamma, or the Sanskrit Dharma, for the simple reason that it has a deeper significance than the word religion in the ordinary sense. Dharma, derived from dhri, means all that which upholds the supreme truth and the actual universal process, ritta, and our word right, R-I-T-E, our word and our word order, and the upholding of eternal order, that is implied in that word ritta. You see? So dharma means the upholding of that eternal order of things. And the Buddha goes on to say, in their ignorance of these things, they are by nature quarrelsome, wrangling and disputatious in maintaining their several views thus and thus. Then he tells this story. Formerly, O monks, there was a certain Raja of this same city of Savatthi. Then, monks, that Raja called a certain man, saying, come thou, my good fellow, go and gather together in one place all the men in Savatthi who were born blind. Very good, sire, replied that man, and in obedience to the Raja gathered together all the men born blind. And then he goes to the Raja and says, sire, they are here. Do with them what you will. Very good, said the Raja, and he spoke to the blind men. He said, O blind men, such as this is an elephant. He had asked the man to bring an elephant into their midst. Remember, they were all born blind. O blind, said the Raja, such as this is an elephant. And to one man he presented the head of the elephant, to another its ear, to another a tusk, to another the trunk, the foot, the back, the tail, and tuft of the tail, saying to each one that that was the elephant. Now, monks, that man, having thus presented the elephant to the blind men, came to the Raja and said, sire, the elephant has been presented to the blind men. Thereupon, that Raja went up to the blind men and said to each, well, blind man, have you seen the elephant? Yes, sire. Then tell me, blind man, what sort of thing is an elephant? Thereupon those who had been presented with the head answered, sire, an elephant is like a pot. And those who had observed an ear, an elephant is like a winnowing basket. those who had been presented with a tusk, that the elephant was a plowshare. Those who knew only the trunk said it was a plow. They said the body was a granary, the foot a pillar, the back a mortar, the tail a pestle, the tuft of the tail just a besom. Then they began to quarrel, shouting, "Yes, it is what I am saying it is." "No, it is not that," the other person would say. "An elephant is not that." "Yes, it's like that." And so on, till they came to fisticuffs over the matter. Then, because that Raja was delighted with the scene, "Just so, O monks, are these wanderers holding other views, blind, unseeing, knowing not the profitable, knowing not the unprofitable. They know not dharma, they know not what is not dharma. In their ignorance of these things, they are by nature quarrelsome, wrangling, and disputatious, each maintaining it is thus and thus." Now the point of all this is as follows. Here were these blind men using four senses only. Mainly, I suppose, their sense of touch. It must have been almost exclusively their sense of touch. And as a result of the use of just what senses they had, they made all these incorrect statements. If they could have had the sense of sight also, none of those statements would have been made. They would have said something totally different. Now we possess five senses as we are, and we contact our world through these five senses. But what is conveyed to us through the five senses, the five physical senses, is interpreted by the brain. It is first synthesized. These sensations are synthesized by the brain, and in association with language, with words, which give names to things, to acts, nouns and verbs, and the whole story emerges out of that. We utilize the senses and language and say that we understand what the actual reality of that thing or person is. Now this is where we are. We don't. So the senses, with their limitations and imperfections, deceive us into thinking that the use of the senses enables us to know reality in its wholeness, in its fullness. This is a very important point to bear in mind. Because of our misperception, all that we say that we perceive is not true perception at all. It is, as the Mahayana puts it, no perception. We are mistaken in our perceptions. There comes the point, by a process of elimination, putting aside the effects of the sense impressions and so forth, putting them aside, we come to the point where, through the complete purification of the brain process as such, the complete purification of it, we arrive at that stage where there is no interpretive activity conditioned by our brain and our memory and all that has been imposed upon us throughout our lifetime. When that happens, it begins to be possible to have true perception. And that true perception becomes entirely true perception only when the one has realized the state of the void, the emptiness as it is called, the shunya. And that shunyata, the emptiness, the voidness, lies at the heart of all things, because that is the full reality of the non-being. And it is out of that fullness of the non-being that the innumerable beings and things and so forth emerge. It is not at all easy to see this clearly. It's very difficult indeed. You will find that if in meditation, or whatever meditation you attempt or practice, you might get the impression, yes, this is it. It isn't. And then you have to discard it. It's a process of continuous asceticism. Asceticism, a continuous sloughing away of everything that suffers from the defects of sense perception and brain interpretation. Brain interpretation utilizing language primarily. Then, in the state of the total voidness, which is not as an unconscious state. It is not a sleepy state. It's not an illusory state. When the real voidness, when you wake up to the real voidness as such, you realize that this is ultimate truth, ultimate reality. You can't go wrong. Then, when you see any one thing as such, or experience any one event, you know the whole truth about it. And you also know that your perception of the whole truth about it, or the person, or whatever it may be, is beyond the possibility of thoughts and words. You see the essence, the truth. It is a wordless thing. And therefore, that seeing the truth does not come about through trying to suppress the flow of speech or thought in one's own being. It just happens naturally. That state becomes released out of oneself, because there is the total transcendental reality underneath are the everlasting arms, as it is put, which is constantly helping you on towards that state. It is there and it affects you without your knowing it. Until you come to the point when you and that are completely at one. So now, when that comes into being, one realizes the true significance of death. Throughout our lives, we are constantly dying. The question is, how shall we die? Shall we die in purity, in goodness, in the state of purity, in the state of enlightenment, or the stages of enlightenment, or shall we die in our sins, so to say, the state of discord, fear, misery, hate, anger, passion, grasping for self, and so forth. If we die in the right way, from moment to moment, there is an emergence into the light. And with that emergence into the light, the truth the actual fact of divine compassion and wisdom, of beauty, of goodness, of happiness, the happiness which is beyond all expression and which causes no unbalance in oneself because of that happiness, that emerges into consciousness, emerges and functions through you. So that one can see that it is never you who enter the kingdom of heaven or attain nirvana, but it is the kingdom of heaven which comes down and manifests through you. And it is nirvana which shines through you and your being. And the brain will never try to interpret that nirvana. The realization of the Supreme Reality is something which is not to be interpreted. If it is interpreted, it means that it is something like a perfect work of art, a most wonderful, divinely beautiful picture has been spoiled by throwing a bucket of filth over it. That's what the brain does. The brain can't help it. See, because the functioning of the brain at root is due to the selfness in our own being. I wish to have this, and that I which wishes and wants is something which thinks of itself and acts as if it were separate from the totality. And it is the state of separateness from the totality which is the sinful state. And in that state of sinfulness, the pure light of transcendence cannot come through you. But as and when that has vanished through the process of discarding everything that we commonly hold or desire to hold, when that is dropped, when that drops off us, then vision becomes pure. And death is seen for its true meaning. You'll find in the Heart Sutra, for instance, the last words there, gone beyond, gone altogether beyond. What an awakening, all hail, Bodhiswaha, gate gate paragate parasangate, gone altogether beyond, Bodhiswaha. I rather feel myself that instead of saying, oh, what an awakening, and all hail, once Bodhiswaha could well be, all hail, all hail to the awakened state. That surely is a more sensible way of putting it than putting it separately. Oh, what an awakening, all hail.